Greetings! I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Exactly.
You know, if you need to have a different way of getting there, it's okay to be inspired by someone else's path, but if you want the moon...
Hey, this is David Poe, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Sherry and Dave Bolivice of Philmont, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC-FM has closed its Hudson studio, and Wayfarm's Acre location is now closed to the public for an indefinite period of time. We are in virtual office mode with modified hours of operation for staff. All existing equipment and studio reservations, workshops, and gatherings are postponed until further notice. Our physical locations may be closed, but WGXE still wants to hear from you. We encourage your communication by email to info@...
Quite right.
And then Brian gets to go, well, it's not my department. Joe handles that. And then we send whoever's asking us on an infinite loop.
Yeah. Then we can blame the network.
Okay, 7:02, we'll be on very soon.
Okay. 7:02?
All right. Fading in. On.
Hello and welcome to the Thingularity Radio Program, broadcasting live from the palatial administrative offices of the Catskill Makers Syndicate, located at 65 West Bridge Street in the heart of Catskill. We are here to answer any science or technology related questions you may have, but nobody ever bothers to ask us, so you know what? If you happen to care, finally, our email address is catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com. And... tonight, well, let's see. We have a special guest tonight. Let's start with that guest. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Christopher Carson. I may be better known in some circles as Publius. I am an advocate for space settlement and atomic energy and generally a better future for humanity. I also appeared in the 2012 documentary film Lunar Sea, among other interesting facts about me, which is actually why I'm on the show tonight.
Alrighty. Okay, now for our listeners, now we know who the guest is, and just to get them acquainted real quick with the people that I have in the room with me, speak out loud. Cody, what's going on?
I said go the other way around.
Go the other way around?
Start with me.
Not a problem. We will start with Trixie tonight.
Hi, Professor Von Mothersbaugh here.
All right, and then we got our historian, Corey.
Yo.
Who's beeping?
You're beeping.
Somebody's beeping.
Tom.
We have
beeping.
A beeping that's guest. His name is Tom. Say hello, Tom.
Beep. Watch.
Beep. Beep.
Say hello.
Hello.
Okay, that's Tom. Cody.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. What?
Okay, Brian, you're lost in the corner. Shout.
There.
All right. He's out there shouting because he's handling the tech. And to my immediate left, we have Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey. All right. Everybody's introduced. The show is rolling. I'm going to kill some of this so that everybody hears us properly. And
your watch.
Yeah. Yeah, drown it.
Two buttons at once, maybe?
We have somebody beeping.
Oh, there it goes. All right.
So yeah, I it was a fortuitous. I do a sticker and letter exchange, and I got a documentary with Christopher here in it, and I thought it was very, very interesting. It's a bunch of moon enthusiasts, I guess you could say. You've got like an artist that went to the moon, and he had a moon boot, and he would press it into the art, and somebody who sells property on the moon, and Christopher here talking about the Luna project, which I guess we'll get into it at some point.
Well, I should hope so.
I should hope so. It's cool.
Interesting, interesting. Moon projects. How do we get there?
Well, I mean, the dumb answer is rockets. I think you probably guessed that already. A slightly better answer is to say
why
that...
Why can't we use a slingshot?
Well, so in principle, you could use a slingshot, okay?
You would just need to be in orbit.
First, you would have to find a material that was good enough to make the rubber band part out of. And we don't have any materials like that. It would have to be very stretchy and have a tensile strength considerably greater than steel.
Okay, now...
Based elevator.
He had a sentence.
Wow. No, he's prepared. I like this. This is great.
This is like working knowledge for
That's the answer I wanted.
He had
cool.
a better answer than rockets, though.
So we're getting there with rockets, apparently, and that now we know that there's a good reason for it. How do we use those rockets, and what are we putting there?
Yeah, I heard the phrase space elevator in the background, and I'd just like to point out that that's a problem which has been studied for a long time, and the single biggest thing is, I have to say, is watch that first step. It's a doozy, because you need to put about 500,000 tons in orbit in order to build a space elevator that actually reaches to the ground. And so all of the space lift requirements for generations into the future could be met by whatever it is you're using to build the space elevator with, without the space elevator at all. I've had talks with people who say, well, the first thing to do is to build a space elevator. And to which I say, yeah, that's kind of like saying, you know, okay, so you want to go to the new world in 1492. The first thing to do is to build a Boeing 747.
Tethers,
right?
Tethers
got issues, especially if you're using like a steel cable. That thing's going to pull a lot of juice out of the atmosphere, and you're going to have to deal with discharges.
Orbital tethers have some interesting possibilities. There is actually a group, the Liftport group, is talking about a orbit to lunar surface space elevator, believe it or not. But that turns out to have some interesting problems. In principle, it could actually be done with a single launch of something like the Falcon Heavy and Spectra, which is a polyethylene-based filament that's used for kites. It's actually the highest tensile strength filament you can buy right now. But there are some serious problems, not the least of which is that if you're dropping down from the L1 libration point, which lies between the Earth and the Moon, if you're dropping down from that distance, the bottom of your space elevator is going to have a fairly high speed over the ground because as the moon moves in its orbit, it makes a sort of nodding motion called the librations in latitude and longitude. And so you wouldn't actually be able to tether it to the surface. It would be whipping back and forth over the surface from the point of view of an observer there at rather high speed, which sounds kind of discouraging to me.
So it sounds more like a vending machine instead of an elevator. It's just going to be...
Yeah, what are those claw machines?
So that's only if we attach it to the surface of the moon, correct?
Yeah, you could suspend it, you know, so that it didn't quite reach the surface, but you still have to deal with the fact that its position, and including altitude, is changing considerably all the time. And so, yeah, it becomes something, I don't know, more like a claw machine or something than a usual form of transportation.
Okay, wouldn't it be then sort of make more sense to have, say, a railgun or a catapult launch from the surface and then some sort of catching mechanism?
Eventually, yes.
Landing pad?
Eventually. Eventually, for sure. The metaphor I like to use here is the Transcontinental Railroad, all right? Nobody built a Transcontinental Railroad across the United States until they had San Francisco at the far end. The point of the initial lunar settlement is to provide you with that terminus, which is where you build to. And the thing is, once you had the Transcontinental Railroad, places like Denver became kind of important, whereas before they had been pretty unimportant. And that's that. That's the point here, is that we have to have psychologically, economically, industrially, in terms of population, we have to have an anchor point at the far end before we can really do industrial development and exploitation in cislunar space. In other words, the space that lies between the Earth and the Moon. That's where most of the action is going to be for a long time to come, because the Earth is going to be, barring some hideous catastrophe, where most of the people are for a long time to come. And most of the people means most of the economic activity. So we may have people going out farther to the asteroid belt, for example, or the libration points of Jupiter, looking for mineral resources. But most of the economic activity is going to be in cislunar space. And when I say economic activity, what I really mean is, and economists lose sight of this all the time, the stuff that people do, all right? And so having a place which doesn't go away, which is always where you looked for it when you saw it last, is very important. You know, the International Space Station, it's one of those things where if you ignore it long enough, it'll go away. It has to be constantly reprovisioned, including with propellants, in order to keep it from falling into the atmosphere and burning up, and possibly landing on people's heads in Australia like Skylab.
To use your metaphor about San Francisco, obviously if Sutter's Mill was found on the moon, and I'm talking about valuable ore like gold, then wouldn't that accelerate the interest in getting up there in a frequency that was sufficient to make it like San Francisco?
There has been a lot of discussion about exactly that. People trying to figure out, is there something we can obtain from the moon that's valuable enough to start a kind of lunar gold rush? Well, the first answer is it certainly isn't gold. Even if we thought there was gold there, which there doesn't seem to be, it would not, by any stretch of the imagination, pay the cost of mining it on the moon and returning it to the Earth. Slightly more complex is the argument about helium-3. Now, the sun has something called the solar wind. It constantly spits atoms out into space, and some of those hit the moon and stick. And some of those atoms are helium, and that helium contains a proportion of what's called helium-3. It's a light isotope of helium. Virtually all the helium on Earth is helium-4, which comes from radioactive decay of heavy elements. Helium-3 could potentially be useful as a nuclear fuel in fusion reactors, but here's the kick. We don't yet know how to build fusion reactors for power. We don't yet know how to build deuterium-helium fusion reactors, which are the easy ones. And then deuterium-helium-3 is an order of magnitude more difficult in terms of actually getting the reaction to work, although it's easier to get the power out because the reaction produces charged particles instead of high-speed neutrons, which are the devil to work with. But yes, if we could develop a fusion power industry, then helium-3 might be valuable. But if we developed a fusion power industry, I mean, that's 20 to 40 years down the line at the earliest. So I'm not exactly holding my breath.
Okay, so what does currently seem to be a viable reason to go up there? Tourism?
So my answer to this is I've got to take you back a little bit and ask you, what was the primary export of the United States before 1870 or so?
Cotton.
The answer is it wasn't. And when I say the primary export of the United States wasn't an export, the answer is the primary export of the United States was vacancies. The reason, the thing that kept the United States afloat was people moving to North America. Essentially, the primary export of the United States was more land for sale in Europe, because people were leaving Europe. But United States did not have a positive balance of payments, positive balance of trade, did not actually start to pay back for Europe as an investment, if you want to look at it that way, until the late 1870s. But people were moving. Entire villages in Europe would save up all the money they could get for 20 or 30 years, and then they would move en masse to the U.S. or Canada, to North America, because there was land to be had. Now, this is obviously not a parallel circumstance, although I will say that for people who moved to, say, North Dakota in the 1870s, it was pretty much as hostile an environment as the moon is for us of today. My Antonia by Willa Cather is actually a good novel about this. People from densely populated Central Europe moving out to North Dakota and thinking, oh my God, I've been deposited, you know, basically in the middle of the devil's bald head.
But they still had creatures roaming the countryside that they could go, wonder what it tastes like.
It's true. So the main answer that I have...
You could also have children there.
Well, if you're protected enough on the moon, and if you're in a, you got radiation protection enough, buried or covered in water, you should be able to have children.
Now, you were going to play devil's advocate. Now you're playing the opposite roles that you told me you were going to play.
Because you're talking and I'm talking opposite you. But Chris resumes.
Now we understand the dynamic.
Oh, I'm just the group mean person.
You're completely in sync with it. No, you are.
I have a very simple economic model, which is that everyone that gets married should consider a honeymoon on the moon where gravity would allow them to perform sexual experiments that somewhat prohibitive.
Yeah. I like that idea because on the moon you have some gravity to help pull away all that sweat.
Yeah, well, it might be a difficult environment to set up for the hotel, but once you're in it, I think you could probably
towels, vacuum, okay, leather straps.
So just wash the
off on a tangent now.
Back to what we were talking about.
So, I mean, this has been seriously considered. Kraft Erika wrote an article for Playboy magazine in 1969. I think it was in the July issue, right, for Apollo 11, which was about space hotels. And, of course, because he was writing for Playboy, he had the opportunity to talk about sex and weightlessness as one of the attractions of such a hotel.
Money.
I also think
people have seriously talked about that as an aspect of space tourism, for sure. Mm-hmm. Of course, the question is how you actually manage it, and the answers seem to be somewhat difficult. But yes, in lunar 1/6 G, you could at least do various things without spraining your back.
In general, tourism
is not a bad income stream. The thing is, already, right, Virgin Galactic has been selling sort of tickets, sort of pre-order commitments for well over a decade now for people to go up in 15 minutes of weightlessness for $100,000. If there are people who will pay $100,000 for that, then there are absolutely people who will pay several million for a 2-week stay on the moon with guided walking tours. So that's an income stream that absolutely one could tap once one was there. That doesn't get you any nearer to actually starting up the initial settlement. And that's why I genuinely believe, if you look at it, I don't think government is going to do it, and I don't think the capital markets are going to do it. But what we tend to forget, but is coming back gradually with things like Kickstarter as a leading example, is that there, in the past, people have done a lot of things not for direct economic return and not because the government told them to, but because a large enough number of people got together with a strong enough desire to actually do it. And that includes some things which are absolutely at the scale of lunar colonization when you talk about the circumstances of the time. So to give you an example, you probably have no idea. The Ottoman Empire, which was for centuries the, you know, bane of Western Europe and particularly the Austrians, got into the First World War on the side of the Austrians, which makes no sense whatsoever. How did this happen? Well, the short answer is Winston Churchill made a big mistake. The slightly longer answer is, with the Young Turks in the ascendant in Turkey, there was a great interest in building a modern navy. And the only way they could build a modern navy was to buy the ships. And so people went around collecting for battleships. People rattling, you know, little tins, and they would go around to all the little hostelries and all the little villages across the Ottoman Empire and say, you know, give us an akçe or two for a battleship. And so from millions of people, literally millions of people, they collected small sums of money, and they were able to get a really good deal on the world's biggest battleship. Because the Brazilians had actually started construction on it at a British shipyard. There was this huge naval arms race going on in South America around 1910 that nobody ever talks about. The Chileans had bought the world's biggest battleship. The Brazilians said, oh, we got to have one bigger than the Chileans have. And so they went to one of the British shipyards and they put their money down and they said, give us the biggest battleship you can build. And the yard said, all right, fine, whatever, and started building it. Well, about halfway through, the Brazilians suddenly discover they were spending 10% of their entire GDP on naval construction. And they said, oh, no, and shut the entire program down, leaving this British shipyard with a partially completed battleship. And they said, well, what are we going to do now? And then the Ottoman ambassador comes to them and says, hey, you got any battleships you could sell for cheap? And they said, have we got a deal for you? And so it was finished. And fitting out at the end of July 1914, the Turkish sailors had actually come on board. They were getting ready to get up steam and take it out for sea trials. Then the war breaks out in Europe. Winston Churchill says, oh no, the Royal Navy doesn't have enough battleships. We need all the battleships we can possibly get, despite the fact that the Royal Navy's battleships were never used at all during the entire course of the First World War. Okay, but he says, we need all the battleships we can get. And so he takes a regiment of soldiers and marches out to where the ship is, marches the Turkish sailors off at gunpoint and seizes the ship, at which point Turkey declares war on Britain. Possibly Churchill's finest hour as a diplomat.
Wow. So what you're saying in all of that is we need a bunch of Kickstarters to get us to the moon.
Let him bring it around.
Absolutely.
All right.
If people care enough about something, right, if people want something enough, they will come up with a way of doing it, right? They will come up with money if money is needed. They will come up with effort if effort is needed. You know, it's desire that's the most fundamental motivating force of the human being. It's not fear. It's not anger. It's not hatred. It's not all those negative emotions. It's not even greed. It's desire. Greed is sometimes desire, but desire is more powerful than that. If you say, well, the one thing I really want in my life is to see people living on the moon, maybe you're willing to take out a second mortgage on your house, right? You got $1 million house and you're willing to take out a second mortgage on it in order to help pay the cost of people going to the moon. This is not an unrealistic scenario. And all that I want is to get together the people who feel passionately about this thing. Because what you must understand is that with today's technology, today's industry, it's not like it was in the 1960s. In the 1960s, it took a big chunk of the entire U.S. GDP. It took a big chunk of the entire U.S. government budget to put a man on the moon. Well, today, firstly, we don't have to do for the first time all the things that they did in the 60s. They invented the microcomputer, for heaven's sake, and that was just sort of a sideline, right? They first had to prove that people could even survive for an hour in weightlessness, because you got to be in weightless for 3 days to get to the moon. They had to prove that people could actually survive that long in weightlessness, which
Thank
was
you,
a disputed
Laika.
Point. Right? They had to prove that you could land on the moon. Today, we don't have to prove any of that. Firstly, because it's been done. And secondly, you look at SpaceX right now, landing booster rockets on barges in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, right? Barge in the Atlantic Ocean, offshore of Florida, it's being tossed back and forth by the waves. There's a crosswind. There's pleasure boaters trying to get in the way and get smashed. I don't understand those people, but that's not important. The thing is, landing anything on the moon where it's airless and the surface is stable and you only have 1/6 the gravity to deal with so you can go down much slower and not just slam into things, it's a piece of cake. We were able to do it with automated systems in 1966.
Now and we China have computers was able to that do it last are more year. Powerful than well, their computer in our pockets.
That's my back to the honeymoons. It's the piece of cake that interests me because zero-G cuisine is probably something that everyone is going to want to taste. I mean, consider a souffle made in a kitchen where there's 1/6 gravity. It's going to be so light and fluffy.
Angel food cake.
You'll really want to go to that hotel because you'll have a desire to be there.
Yeah, but there's some things you're not going to want to have.
So, Chris, you don't think that all this is going to be achieved by, you said, capital. So you mean, as you mentioned, the likes of SpaceX, Elon Musk, what's the other one that Bezos started? Blue Origin. Yeah. You don't think it's going to be done by them?
I think they have a part to play.
Yeah.
But remember, I mean, SpaceX and Blue Origin, both of them, they're building rockets, right? Rockets are transportation to something. Transportation to something is, you know, is it dependent on someone actually wanting to go somewhere, right? Yeah. You can start, you know, again, it's that you don't build a railroad to someplace unless there are people who are already going there, right? They're, you know, if they're going to build rockets to go to the moon or whatever, they're going to build it because someone is paying them to do so. I mean, yes, Elon wants to go to Mars or whatever. Yeah, I mean, that's very cool. Bezos, I don't know what he wants, you know, lurking in his, you know, his fortress of solitude or whatever. Clearly, he wants something else. But realistically,
power.
Both of them are very much dependent on someone wanting to go the direction they go. You know, SpaceX has prospered the way it has because when the SpaceX came on the scene, NASA had just made a very big policy change. Instead of trying to shut down commercial space launch providers in the United States, they were looking at buying from commercial space launch providers. In the past, they literally had gone out of their way to shut down people who were offering commercial launch services. And in fact, the U.S. government continues to do that in other countries. Brazil, for example, the U.S. government has been a major force in stopping the Brazilians from having space launch.
Wow.
But NASA made a decision that they wanted to procure commercial launch services. And so Musk was able to sell into that as a market for things that commercial customers weren't yet willing to buy. Not because commercial customers didn't have a need for them, but because commercial customers for space launch services are very conservative. They don't want to buy something if somebody else hasn't paid for it first, if they haven't already seen it work. And that was what NASA was paying for, was stuff that hadn't exactly been done yet. And so once the commercial people were seeing it was being done, they said, oh, we want a piece of that. So yeah, once we actually have people living and working and doing normal people things on the moon, then industry, industrial capital, and so on are going to get involved. And on the way there, they're absolutely going to have a role to play, but they're not going to get us there because they do not have an incentive to do something that's untried and unproven. Thing is, right, back in the late 19th century, I've got a bond certificate from a railway where many of the railways were built. You won't believe this, but they were built on money that was borrowed for, say, 5% interest, 4 or 5% bonds, 300, 400, 500 year bonds.
What?
You cannot get money on terms like that anymore. Wow. It's difficult, in fact, to get money for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Seriously, the market wants you to turn a profit, wants their money back very, very rapidly. And so venture capital is not interested in schemes like space settlement. The profits to be realized in a sort of abstract sense from things like asteroid mining, space solar power, ultimately the construction of O'Neill colonies, which will allow us to have dozens of times the surface area of the Earth. The long-term profits are immense, but you won't begin to see a profit of any kind for 100 years.
Yeah, they'll be reaped by our descendants, not us.
Yes.
Or anybody absolutely. Who's alive today, really.
I mean, there are people who are banking on life extension technologies. I'm not willing to write it off completely. On the other hand, my sibling likes to say the problem with life extension technologies is they will go first and foremost to the people you really do not want to live longer.
Yeah.
Walt Disney's head is still frozen.
Okay, I'm one of those people who doesn't see humans being on the moon, but robots, and the robots are easily capable of populating the moon in the amounts that you referred to as the magnet for railroads going to the West Coast, and if you can get something out of the robots. It doesn't require that there be all the oxygen and nutrients that humans require, then there's no point in putting the emphasis on the small contributors or the big long-term investors or whatever, because there is a reason that you can get a return from the machines that you put up there. And I'll further say that one of the sources of one of the foci would be big science. Big science wants the moon. They want the backside of the moon because there's no radio interference. They want the front side of the moon because it provides a view of the Earth. There are all kinds of ways that you can take large sums of money that are going to projects on Earth and put them on the moon and benefit enormously. I come from astronomy, and they've spent billions on telescopes that would be much better on the moon. So, you know, it's an inhospitable location –